The relationship between the UK and China has been seriously poisoned, says Beijing's ambassador to London. China's called for New Zealand to correct its mistake. After our suspension of an extradition treaty with Hong Kong, the South China Morning Post says the free fall in US-China relations has significantly heightened the chances now for escalation or miscalculation between the superpowers. Sentiment against China over the security law in Hong Kong, its expansionist moves in the South China Sea, its treatment of the Muslim Uyghurs is nothing new. But taken together, the ill will on both sides appears to be escalating. Our China correspondent is Nathan van der Klip, who's also the Asia correspondent for the Globe and Mail, and he's based in Beijing. Hello, Nathan.
Hello.
In the US, the Democrats and Republicans, they're both down on China pre-election, and I see a Pew poll found 66% of US adults hold a negative view of China, which is the highest percentage ever. Nathan, I suppose the question is whether China barges through this level of mistrust and opposition and keeps trying to get its way in a variety of spheres, or whether it comes up against enough of a wall. What is your view?
Well, I find these questions difficult to answer because it's easy to get so focused on the U.S.-China relationship, which is obviously doing very badly. So if you're sitting in Beijing, yes, your relationship with the U.S. is massively important, given the size of the U.S. economy, given the importance of the U.S. in terms of innovation and trade and other things. But I think you can also make the argument for China that, you know what, okay, so the U.S., things aren't going well. That things aren't going well with allies of the U.S., but there's a whole other world out there. There are massive other parts of the world in which sort of things have been going much better for China. I think it's probably worrisome that things are now going badly for China in India as well. I mean, there are signs that this is expanding beyond Washington and its closest friends. I think that the full picture is slightly more complex than the much more dire circumstances that we see right now between Washington and Beijing.
Yeah, I understand. Domestically, how does this play out, China against the world? I saw a recent study suggesting that Chinese citizens' satisfaction with their government has increased since 2003, for example.
Well, one of the hallmarks of Xi Jinping's presidency has been the use of nationalism as a tool of governance. And one of the things that I've been noticing lately, I mean, this hasn't just started in the last month, but we're seeing more and more of it, is the language of national dignity. And you see this a lot in terms of China's international relations, in terms of how it demands other people treat the Chinese government, that there can be no affront to China's national dignity. And those are very nationalistic terms. They're terms that suggest that there can be no insult and no offense. And of course, they can be very broadly used. The appearance or the strengthening of what look to be hostile forces abroad can strengthen a sense of domestic unity and domestic support for the direction of the country, which of course works exceedingly well for China's leadership. There have been people who for decades now have been calling for the imminent implosion of China, and they have all been proven wrong.
Nathan van der Klip is with us. Is the situation in Hong Kong worsening with the arrests now of student leaders on charges of secession? Because this would seem to underscore the fear that freedom of speech is dying if you can no longer post on social media advocating independence, for example.
Well, I mean, if you read the text of the national security law, it's quite clear in that it gives the police effectively an unfettered ability to censor speech. If you look at the statements that have come out by Hong Kong's leadership and by the police, they have set very clear lines that the mere expression of support for independence, the mere uttering of the term revolution of our times, which has been one of the bywords of the protest movement that has taken root in Hong Kong over the past year, all of these things are now being considered evidence of secessionism and splitism. We saw also this week the disqualification of a dozen candidates for the upcoming legislative council elections in Hong Kong. In most of our countries, we would consider the idea of trying to change the government's path as the central role of an opposition party. But we are now seeing rhetoric out of Hong Kong that suggests any attempt to do so is considered a sign of secessionism.
In tandem with the banning of those 12 candidates was a statement which said there is no question of any political censorship, restriction of the freedom of speech or deprivation of the right to stand for elections. And that was a head scratcher. You can't have both.
You can have both in the sense that you can arrest people and you can say that you're not arresting people.
Right.
I mean, okay. You can have a gap between rhetoric and reality, and I think that gap is widening in Hong Kong. And I think what we're also going to see is, you know, the UK appears to be moving towards this plan to provide a path to residency and perhaps citizenship for something like 3 million holders of these British national overseas passports. So there's all sorts of things afoot. And I mean, we have seen in the past, on multiple occasions after 1989 with the Tiananmen massacre, before 1997 with the handover of Hong Kong from the UK to China, we have seen mass emigration from Hong Kong. And so if history is a guide, there is reason to think we may see something along those lines again.
One last thing. NBC in the US is reporting on a problem that's not new, but it won't go away. In the last year, 150 ghost boats from North Korea have washed ashore in Japan, more than 500 in the last 5 years, with skeletons on board. What is going on?
It's such a fascinating story because it's one of these things where you have a confluence of so many factors that are coming together to produce this genuinely eerie phenomenon of either empty boats washing ashore in Japan or boats with skeletons on board, some of them so badly decomposed that the authorities have struggled even to identify their gender. And it appears to be a few things. One, with the sanctions against North Korea, there was a ban on foreign fishing inside North Korean waters, and that was designed to stop North Korea from profiting from selling fishing rights to foreign countries. What appears to have happened is that an enormous fleet of Chinese long-distance fishing vessels have gone in to North Korean waters to fish for squid. And there's been a few things that have taken place. One, there's been such an enormous amount of fishing. I mean, we're talking something like 800 boats, that the squid populations in those areas have declined by something like 70%. You have fisheries experts talking about the possibility of collapse. But the other is that it appears to have done a few things, one of which is to displace North Korean domestic fishermen, forcing them to go farther abroad, some of who have perhaps gotten caught up in storms or perhaps run out of fuel for their boats and died at sea, unable to come back ashore and then drifted on the currents over to Japan. And another element of this is that one of the things the sanctions have done is made it more difficult for North Korea to secure fuel. So you have sanctions and you have this enormous number of knock-on effects that have seemed to have conspired to produce this ghostly phenomenon.
I know, it's a ghastly chapter as well. Nathan, thank you very much for your time as always.
You're very welcome.